Haiti has long had a reasonable claim to the title of Earth's most luckless country. It is currently one of the most lawless. In recent weeks, what little there was of a functional Haitian state has collapsed entirely. Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, is currently controlled, almost certainly the wrong word, by gangs who have opened prisons, besieged the airport, and burned down the house of the National Police Director. Haiti's hapless Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, is marooned in Puerto Rico. He has agreed to resign when a transitional government can be formed. As of this broadcast, there is little agreement about how any such arrangement would actually work. Haiti has descended into this ditch via an unhappy 21st century sequence of natural disaster, disease, coups d'etat, political turbulence, gang violence, and the assassination in 2021 of President Jovenel Moïse. Haiti's more distant history isn't much happier. All of the above, plus decades of 20th century dictatorship, bookended by American-led interventions, which clearly failed to solve the underlying problems. How did things in Haiti manage to get even worse? What can anybody else do about it? And perhaps more importantly, do they want to do it? This is the Foreign Desk.
Last night I was standing on my porch, and I could hear the heavy shooting happening in Perigny, which is about 10, 15 kilometers from here. So to me, it's very real. And there's no airport to get out to. There's nothing. Everything is at stake right now. And if nothing is done seriously and consequentially, we are facing a disaster of unknown proportions.
Today, what has people on edge is that it's creeping up so that you don't know when your neighborhood is going to be the next one that's hit. And yesterday, the police chief's house was set on fire and it was pillaged. And that truly has sent people into a panic, because when the police chief is now a victim, and as somebody said to me, when the police chief cannot protect himself, then what about us?
The problem is, over the last 30 plus years now, since the transition of 1988 post Duvalier, when Monicat was elected, has been one of trying to funnel a lot of the support to NGOs, creating what former World Bank President Bob Zoellick called a nation of NGOs. And that's severely weakened the capacity of the state. And so what will have to happen alongside any security solution is an effort to build state capacity, not just in Port-au-Prince, but across the island.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Harold Isaac, a journalist based in Port-au-Prince, and by Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent at the Miami Herald. Jacqueline recently travelled to Port-au-Prince. She joins us from Miami. Harold, first of all, where you are, what is a day in the life of Port-au-Prince like now?
Well, it's unpredictable, really. I mean, like, honestly, every day you need to assess whether you're going to work or to your office, run errands, or if you're going to stay put and be cautious and look out, you know, for what's going on. Today is kind of an iffy day, you know, and I've been talking to friends who are working in hot areas and they're concerned. Last night was rather tense. There were kind of a surge of violence in various parts of the city.
Just to follow that up, Harold, is this one of those violent situations where at least it's understandable where the violence is and roughly what the dynamic of it is? Is there any kind of, I guess, internal logic to it, or does it just feel extremely random and chaotic?
Well, in general, it does. And this is what feels different this time. This time around, we're failing to understand that logic. Initially, it was clear that there was mounting pressure to get former Prime Minister Ariel Henry to step down, or at least to accept the principle of his resignation. And now that that has happened, well, why does the violence persist?
I'll bring you in at that point, Jacqueline, because the phrase different this time, which Harold just used, I think is important. You were in Haiti, as I understand it, as recently as December. Did you have a feeling then that something was bubbling? And if so, what was that thing?
I mean, when I was in Haiti, and I'd been in Haiti last year several times, different occasions, but I was on edge. It was the first time that I truly was freaking out. You're on the road, and if you're the only car on the road, you're still not comfortable because you don't know when a car is going to pull out from a corner and stop you, and you become the next victim of a killing or a kidnapping. It was just like you felt that every minute you were on the road, you were basically taking a risk. Now, this is in December, and earlier in January, I was in the north of the country in Cape Haitian, and I went to the border, the Dominican Republic, and I was coming back to Cape Haitian late at night in the dark after 10 o'clock. And I remember thinking, this is not a very responsible thing to do, but it was a different kind of thrill. It was like, oh my God, this is what we used to do in Haiti all the time, even with some sense of, even with some measure of a little bit of insecurity, right? But you didn't have that feeling of panic that something is gonna pull out and you're going to be this next victim. So when you compare those two, it really tells you of just how quickly things change, how volatile it is. I think today the feeling also, to elaborate on what Harold was saying, is that if you are away from the violence, we've been watching this and we've been seeing these attacks in particular neighborhoods or no-go zones that you can say to yourself. But today, what has people on edge is that it's creeping up so that you don't know when your neighborhood is going to be the next one that's hit. You don't know if it's going to leave the lower part of the capital and come over. And yesterday, the police chief's house was set on fire and it was pillaged. And that truly has sent people into a panic, because when the police chief is now a victim, and as somebody said to me, when the police chief cannot protect himself, then what about us?
Harold, please do contradict this assumption if it's incorrect, but one of the things that is being reported by way of explaining what's different this time is this idea that the gangs have perhaps ceased squabbling amongst themselves more than usual and are united at least in part. This claim obviously being relayed mostly by this character, Jimmy Charissier, a former police officer who likes to be addressed as Barbecue. And I guess there's a subsidiary question there, which is he a serious person or is he just one of these people who often crops up in moments of conflict and chaos and has a knack for getting on television?
I think the gangs themselves are in an unprecedented level of power. And even themselves, they're like surprised at how much reach they have. I mean, clearly there was an objective, 2 weeks ago, was to take out Premier Ariel Henry. Now that that has happened, the gangs find themselves in this very particular situation where if you were in a classic traditional armed conflict, there would be entitled to get the legitimate power. Yet now, as bandits, they're also constrained to their very nature of being bandits. So how do you assume legitimate power in this configuration? And how would that actually happen? So it's a lot of pending questions, really open-ended discussions on where we're headed. And I think, if I may, that the core issue really is what happened with the airport. I mean, for many people, the airport was off limits. You may hear everything happening because both the good guys and the bad guys go through the airport. So why would they attack the airport? And the very fact that that has happened, as Jackie was saying, has sent shockwaves through the society because a lot of people are now stranded. They cannot go anywhere. And what we're seeing here is helicopters flying in and out for those who are the most privileged. But for everyday folks that would be able to flee, they feel that they're totally stranded with nobody coming for them, not even including the U.S. with its almighty army that could have at least come for the international airport. So this is where the discussions are in Haiti right now.
But just to follow that up quickly, Harold, and to focus on those figures who are making a name for themselves, not just Jimmy Barbecue Charissier, but the rapper gangster Izo and the former cop and veteran rebel Guy Philippe. Again, are any of these regarded as actually serious players with a serious constituency, or are they just, I guess, kind of self-publicists?
All of the above. I mean, honestly, the problem is, as it stands, and this is why we had a bit of a precarious piece the beginning of the week everybody was waiting for what would come out of the talks, the emergency talks that were happening in Jamaica. And that reprieve seemed to indicate that the gangs were saying, well, let's see what comes out of this, right? Even the gangs were waiting for what would come out of it. And now that even these talks and what they had promised is kind of crumbling unto itself, because we had been promised a council within the 48 hours. Now we have six names. There's one missing. There's infightings. And you know, honestly, and it's not to be defending former Prime Minister Ariel in any shape or form, but you went from one sitting head of state, de facto, illegal, illegitimate, you name it, to now seven people that will be fighting each other on everything. So it's a really kind of weird formula that feels more here as an experimentation, because we've never approached, you know, leading the country in such a way. What happens next is anybody's guess, honestly.
Let me follow up on that. Harold makes a really important point. I think that one of the problems with folks outside of Haiti who are trying to assist Haiti is that they truly do not understand the Haitian dynamics. They don't understand how Haitian politics work, the Haitian political DNA. So they try to impose or suggest these formulas that have worked in other places, but don't understand why they don't work in Haiti, because they don't study Haiti. I mean, when we look around Haiti and you see these cartels, they don't work. There's always this infighting. There's always a conflict. And in fact, most of the public don't even know who's on the cartel, because if you have a strong personality, that strong personality ends up emerging as being the mayor, you know, the person. So today you have individuals who never wanted to get together when the late President Jovenel Moïse was there and to enter some sort of a political deal with him, because this crisis did not begin with Ariel Henry. I mean, everybody's been focused on Henry, but Haiti didn't suddenly fall into gangland in the last 3 years. This has been building. It was existed before the 2010 earthquake, but you had something called the UN peacekeeping force that was there that was able to sort of keep it at bay. And then we had the 2010 earthquake, and we had the controversial elections. And that's, instead of the country going upward, the country went into a downward spiral. And so we landed in this deep, deep crisis, because we are in a constitutional void. There is not one elected official in the country. Why? Because under President Moïse, he did not have an election for 4 years. You know, we don't have a parliament. Why? Because 18 months before he was killed, he declared that parliament was dysfunctional, you know, with a tweet. So you have seven people who had refused to go into any sort of deal. They're adversarial to begin with. And now you're telling them that I want you to sit there and get along. And when you add now the additional dynamics, not just, I was writing about the infighting all week, but now it's not even the infighting that's the bigger issues. It's the security. People are afraid. Yes, there is an acting prime minister, but the image in what is that you've told the gangs that they've won because they got what they want. And you still haven't figured out how you're going to put something in place to fill this void. And this right here, figuring out the nine names on a council, that's the easy part. They still don't know how it's going to function. Who is going to be the president? Do you rotate every couple of months? And then you have to pick a prime minister. And in the Haitian psyche, the prime minister is the one who is in charge of the day-to-day governance of the country. So we are really in for a rough ride on top of the acute problem, which is the security problem. You know, will a political deal address your security problem? And I think right now we're seeing that's not the case.
Jacqueline, I just want to come back to something you were saying about the gangs there, and you're quite right. They are not a new phenomenon. In that time, what have we understood about how they are run, how they are funded, how they are organized?
You know, we've all been trying to figure this out, and I think that those who get paid more than us, and this is their job, I don't know if they've actually done the investigations, because it would help. But what I can tell you this is that what I have noticed is that we went from a period where there was this feeling that these gangs were controlled by certain politicians or people in the business sector, either because the gangs were extorting or they were being used by different individuals. And there's a UN, you know, panel of experts report that sort of talks about, you know, the role of the gangs in Haitian society and in Haitian politics and in the business community. But when the US and Canada started issuing sanctions, and they came out, which was a shift in their foreign policy, what you started to see was that people in Haiti, the private sector, the politicians, they were afraid to deal with the gangs. So when the gangs were, certain gangs were trying to extort it, oh, I can't give you money because I am going to get like sanctioned. But the gangs had a payroll. So with the introduction of sanctions, we started to see an increase in kidnappings. We started to also see that the gangs increasingly started to break away from these relationships that they were having with politicians. And I think there's even been public comments by some of the diplomats who work on Haiti, you know, who have said that, well, we don't think that the political class is that involved anymore. But bottom line was the gangs were becoming increasingly more independent. So now the problem is, or the question is, who controls them?
Just finally, I'll come back to you, Harold, because you're right in the middle of it. As you look ahead to the next few weeks, at least, and we will be looking longer ahead in the latter part of this program, but do you perceive any grounds for optimism at all from where you're sitting?
In all honesty, I barely can see tomorrow. Here's the thing. I mean, we all, and I think with the magic of technology, it's all, and for our listeners right now, they would feel that we're all sitting in the same room. Last night I was standing on my porch and I could hear the heavy shooting happening in Perrier, which is about 10, 15 kilometers from here. So to me, it's very real, and there's no airport to get out to. There's nothing. I mean, you could be running in the hills, but how far would you go, right? I mean, everybody said it every possible way they could. Everything is at stake right now. And if nothing is done seriously and consequentially, we are facing a disaster of unknown proportions. You know, I mean, right now we're talking about half of the population facing famine-like situation. And that's not me saying it. You have three UN agencies pulling the alarm. You have the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince, people are threatened with famine. And the Haitian government, since October of 2022, had asked for international support to deal with the security crisis. And we're 2 hours away from Miami. I mean, there's a lot of politics being played over this, but there's also a reality that is a very dire reality that is getting worse and worse by the hour.
Harold Isaac and Jacqueline Charles, thank you both very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. You're listening to the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. Explaining what has gone wrong in Haiti is daunting enough. Outlining possible solutions is another magnitude of task entirely, but we're going to give it a try. Joining me here in the studio is Dr. Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at Chatham House. He has been following events in Haiti closely. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Georges Fariol, a Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Fellow with the Caribbean Policy Consortium, and a member of the think tank Haiti Steering Group. Chris, let's start with you here in London, and let's start with one solution which has been at least proposed, though I think it's now on hold. This was the idea of a mission led by Kenya. They were going to send 1,000 police officers to Port-au-Prince. Other countries had vaguely offered to pitch in, the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Barbados, Chad, possibly Benin. Would a mission like that be sufficient to address the current situation?
I don't think it ever was when it was originally proposed. Clearly, what was at work was the U.S., Canada, the countries that before had staffed out, Brazil included, previous U.N. and international missions in Haiti, were tired. There's a certain amount of Haiti fatigue. So, unfortunately, they tried to pass the buck. And I don't think those countries would have been prepared, certainly in October 2023, when it was originally proposed, and they were sort of signed up or sort of enlisted. Even more so now, because what's going to be required, as we're seeing, is the gangs take over not just more and more of Port-au-Prince, but also the airports and the ports. Some sort of force is going to actually probably have to fight to get in. It's going to require some firepower. Police forces will not be sufficient. You're going to need combat-ready troops, unfortunately.
On the subject of firepower, Georges, that's probably when we should ask the obvious question, which is the mightiest military power on earth is not very far away from Port-au-Prince, and a brief scrutiny of Haitian history will demonstrate that the Americans know the way. So why does the United States not want to get involved in this?
Well, some of it Chris just alluded to. It's sort of a generalized fatigue about Haiti policy. I mean, this is not the first time that the citizens at large from the United States face another Haitian crisis over the last three decades. I think there's a little bit of that. There's also, I think, a sense that after Afghanistan, after Iraq, for the older generation, even after Vietnam, there is a sense somehow that the United States is involved in too many foreign adventures, none of them particularly appealing or successful. I think there is also, in some ways, in the present context, an aspect of U.S. policy, and Canadian policy, as it turns out also, which I think is important to remember, which is in the current crises in the last 3 or 4 years, there has been actually an attempt to learn from the lessons of the past, of the previous interventions in Haiti, sort of a lessons learning exercise, which has mutated into sort of an effort of a Haitian-led solution as the precondition for any involvement by the international community. Unfortunately, what this has sort of turned into is not so much a search for a Haitian-led solution, or at least try to support such an effort, but a kind of a hands-off hesitation effort. And as a result, we find ourselves now with the poorest of all possible situation.
Can I just add something to what George said, which is it's also an election year in the United States.
Right.
An election year in which there is a large sort of America's First movement, which could possibly win the election, a very strong anti-immigrant, and I would even say xenophobic component to that America First movement. That's simply, you know, trying for the Biden administration, trying to defend a more robust U.S. involvement in Haiti is very difficult. It could be politically toxic. So there's also that element, which is unfortunate but true.
George, this is all a bit pie in the sky theorizing at the moment, but if the political will developed in the United States for whatever reason to actually take the lead on Haiti as the United States has done in the past, would a significant military intervention by the United States actually make a difference? Because it does look, on the face of it, like an absolute no-brainer. Most of these gangs wreaking havoc in Haiti are comprised of kids, basically, reasonably lightly armed, wearing flip-flops and T-shirts, barely paid, if at all. Are they really going to stick around to try their luck with the 82nd Airborne?
Unlikely. And I think you see the current push by gangs to even increase their control over particularly the capital city area, I think is more of a negotiating posture on their part to position themselves so that they're part of any political outcome, political solution among various Haitian political actors, as well as some form of a negotiating position vis-a-vis the international community whenever it comes in. Now, maybe some of them might be looking for amnesty or some form of political resolution. I think in some ways, U.S. engagement, security, military engagement may be more advanced than we may want to assume, despite sort of the reluctance to get too engaged. I mean, in the last, 36, 48 hours, the United States has put in place a Marine platoon that's highly specialized protecting the U.S. embassy. My suspicion is that there may be other units that are actually somewhere either on their way to Haiti or in Haiti itself, primarily designed for getting kind of a better grasp of what the gang situation really is. There may even be some backdoor conversations going on with some of the more notorious gang leaders. This is not to suggest that there is a dramatic shift in U.S. thinking, but I think there is a realization that the mediation process that went on earlier this week in Jamaica doesn't seem to be generating the outcome that everyone expected. And there's something of a standoff, but in the meantime, it's not so much that the gangs are gaining ground. They basically control the capital city and other areas around the country. But the more this drags on, the more this weakens whatever's left of the rest of Haitian political society as well as civil society. So I think I'm not suggesting that we're going to suddenly wake up one morning with the Marines having come ashore, but I think there's more thinking and more planning in this regard than it looks like from the outside. And I think in some ways, the process may be further down the road than we may think.
Chris, this is a very broad question, for which apologies in advance. But we've talked a bit already about why people don't want to get involved and why perhaps other people shouldn't get involved. But is there an imaginable solution of any kind to Haiti that does not at some level involve a hefty military threat?
I guess the short answer is no. You need to retake territory. You need to reestablish, to quote Max Weber, the monopoly on the legitimate use of force in Haiti, and that doesn't exist. Right now, you have a police force in Haiti of only 9,000 police officers trying to maintain security in a country of 11.5 million. So it's going to require some effort to bolster these security forces. But we can't separate that effort to bolster security forces from the need to establish state capacity across the board. That is obviously in security. It's also in infrastructure. It's also in healthcare. It's also in education. Those things have deteriorated dramatically. And we can't sort of separate them from the incapacity of the Haitian state to effectively just govern, to conduct public administration. As boring as that may sound, it has to happen. And Bob Zoellick...
Boring administration is the secret of civilized life.
That's exactly right. Bureaucracy is sort of what makes states and governments function. And the problem is, over the last, almost 30 plus years now, since the transition of 1988 post-Duvalier when Manicat was elected, has been one of trying to funnel a lot of the support to NGOs, creating what former World Bank President Bob Zoellick called a nation of NGOs. Mm. And that's severely weakened the capacity of the state. And so what will have to happen alongside any security solution is an effort to build state capacity, not just in Port-au-Prince, but across the island.
George, is part of Haiti's problem, on top of Haiti's many, 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 many other problems, that nobody, or at least not enough people, perceives a national interest of their own in getting involved? Everybody is just at this point going, there's nothing we can do about this, and it's not really our problem anyway.
The question, I think, maybe underestimates what I still think is a relatively robust Haitian civil society. I think part of the issue there, maybe to some degree, I may be speculating here, but it's not that the international community is too involved, it's that in some ways doesn't seem to try to figure out a way so that it can support a reasonable outcome in Haiti itself. The problem with that approach, it's not that Haitians can't come up with a solution, is that the international community, in the United States in particular, has somehow been evasive as to which of these different options that the Haitians are proposing it wants to support. And as a result, nothing has happened that's constructive.
I'd just like to add something. With both George and I having been involved in Haiti for a while, is the problem also is the U.S. and international actors are sometimes diplomatically lazy in sort of going to the same usual suspects in the political class. And that's the risk even in this transition council, any sort of council and future sort of management structure, interim management structure to get to the next elections, is that they'll just go to either the original, the people that George and I know well from having gone to Haiti in the 1990s and 2000s, or their sons and daughters or nieces and nephews, and not reaching out to fresher, more grounded, if you will, civil and political class that really represents a different way of doing business. And that's the problem, is in this rush, and this is, it's always a rush in Haiti, whether to get to the next election, to establish some sort of security response or humanitarian relief response after the disastrous earthquake of 2010, is that there's a rush to not actually make sure that the people that are represented in these coalitional interim assignments or whatever are actually representative.
George, on that thought, we are coming to that part of the program where we try to say something, if not wholly optimistic, then at least vaguely constructive. Do you think then in that Haitian civil society that you described, there might be found the foundations of a functioning state? Obviously, it's a lot easier said than done because the gangs will have to be disarmed, and I don't get the impression that's going to happen just by asking them nicely. And order will need to be, well, not merely restored, but actually imposed. But if that could be done, do you think the basis of a functional state does actually still exist somewhere amid this chaos?
Well, let me throw out sort of a theory, which is that Haiti in some ways suffers not so much from being a failed state as of having failed governance. The difference here being that there are actually a number of options that have been announced and outlined in the last 2-3 years, different groupings among Haitians, the Montana group, the December the 21st agreement, even the current negotiations ongoing this week in Jamaica in the context of some sort of a presidential council, in some ways feed into or build out from those original ideas. So to me, the issue here is trying to come up with something that all Haitians can agree on. And at this point, the problem maybe with this notion of a presidential council is that to build on what Chris just said, it seems to feed into the same kinds of people who haven't been able to agree on anything in the last two or three years. So this is not likely to be a successful option. The alternative, which seems to be out there floating around, is actually something resembling one of the earlier Haitian transitions where the international community was involved, which is the 2004 transition in the second ouster, if you will, or collapse of the Aristide government, which engaged a more formal quasi-constitutional process involving the head of Haiti's Supreme Court, the Cour de Cassation. There are sort of rumblings among different Haitian political actors that's actually maybe the preferred option. That doesn't seem to be the option that those being the international community actors, including the United States, seem to be focused on right now in Jamaica. I'm not quite sure I prefer one over the other, but the reason why I mention this sort of interpretation or update, if you will, of the 2004 transition is that at least it has something more of a Haitian content to it, if you will, than a negotiating process that's done over in Kingston and done by a bunch of foreign actors, which have invited a number of Haitian stakeholders. I'm a little hesitant to say that that's going to be a winning combination.
Well, just finally then, Chris, and this question is a wild grasp at a straw, but is there any mileage even theoretically in attempting to negotiate with the gangs now more or less running Haiti and try to incorporate them into some sort of political process, or are they just completely venal, non-ideological, and absolutely not interested?
You shouldn't negotiate with them. That's not to say there shouldn't be some process of discussion and reintegration. Most of these are teenagers looking for a job, looking for money. They're not criminals by nature. So there is an opportunity and a coordinated development and security strategy that allows for them to be reintegrated into sort of formal legal society. So I think that can happen. But at the top level, these are, Guy Philippe, one of the leaders, attempted a coup in 1994, served time in a U.S. prison for money laundering. Jimmy Cherizé is also, known for extortion. A lot of these people, they shouldn't be brought into a government. Having said that, many will have, quite likely, if this negotiation takes place without new actors, many of them will have a backdoor access to those negotiations and that process of rebuilding because many have contacts to political groups. So they have to be dealt with. But they have to be dealt with, first of all, in terms of securing the country and integrating, if you will, their foot soldiers into formal society. With these individual leaders, maybe there's some form of amnesty, what have you, but they should not have a formal role in government. These are corrupt criminals involved in extortion, kidnapping, rape, drug trafficking, arms smuggling, not the sort of nice guys you want to have dictating government policy.
Christopher Sabatini and Georges Fariol, thank you both very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk and The Foreign Desk Explainer were produced and edited by Emma Searle, Christy O'Grady, Jack Dewars, and Lily Austin. To contact The Foreign Desk team, you can email Emma at es@monocle.com, and don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.